This is Building Bridges with Kanesh and Mimi Rosenberg, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Where do we go from here? Rekindling the revolutionary King's ideas and the activism that followed on this 50th anniversary since his martyrdom. We are speaking with Claiborne Carson, who is a professor at Stanford University, a history professor and director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute, which edits and publishes Dr. King's papers, and is indeed the foremost scholar in the country looking at the works and legacy of Martin Luther King, and Michael Honey, historian and author as well of the just released To the Promised Land, Martin Luther King and the Fight for Economic Justice, and of course the acclaimed book before that, Going Down Jericho Road, The Memphis Strike, Martin Luther King's Last Campaign, the issue of really the whole King, a man of civil and human rights, but understood the imperative to intermesh that with economic justice and made that a fight of his life as well. And Michael, we are speaking to you now on this 50th anniversary of the assassination of King from the Lorraine Motel. So welcome. Yes. And
sitting in the Lorraine Motel in one of the staff offices, just a great moment. People are pouring into Memphis from all over the place. This morning I was at Mason Temple. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees are having a two-day conference there called IM 2018. They're bringing people from all over, and the purpose is to use the memory of this event 50 years later as a way to rekindle movements for social justice and particularly economic justice. From a worker's point of view, but also they're very concerned about mobilizing people for the 2018 elections to try to remove some of the reactionary forces that are dominating Congress. So it's a two-pronged thing, and it's going to get bigger tomorrow. And then here at the previous Lorraine Motel, which is now the National Civil Rights Museum, there's 3 days of activities 50 years since King. So I call this the bonds of memory, that it makes a difference how people remember. So my work, as Dr. Carson knows, is really about the economic justice issues. And in the book that I just published, To the Promised Land, Martin Luther King and the Fight for Economic Justice, I start there with slavery. And when I started working on this book, I was sort of surprised. I sort of knew it, but I really started pinning it down, and it was almost surprising to me how much he talked about slavery. And of course, his great-grandparents were slaves, some of them. His grandparents were sharecroppers, lived under the cruel segregation, which was slavery by another name, as King said, and was born in 1929 at the beginning of the Great Depression, lived in an area of Atlanta that was very poor. And so our idea of King, you know, in a suit and tie at the March on Washington, sort of the way the media has portrayed him through the years, and particularly back then, was this is a civil rights advocate. And James Lawson, who's a great informative person on all of this, says you have to first understand the social gospel, and second, that he's a nonviolence advocate. And once you're a nonviolence advocate, that covers everything. It covers war, covers poverty, economic injustice. It certainly covers what happened here in Memphis with 1,300 men out on strike for the right to a living wage. 40% of them lived below poverty. They could be fired at any time. They had no rights on the job whatsoever. They weren't recognized by the city, even though they had organized a union. And two men were killed on February 1st. That should never have been killed. It was faulty equipment that the union had demanded over and over again to replace. And that was kind of the thing that pushed it over on February 12th. It was sort of like the Montgomery bus boycott. The workers met. There's 1,300 black workers in sanitation. They met the night before at a labor temple, and they decided not to go on strike. They decided, we're not going back to work. This is intolerable. It was against the law for them to strike as public employees, even though they had no rights as union members. But it was sort of like the Montgomery bus boycott, where they waited Monday morning to see if anybody, you know, rode on the buses, and lo and behold, nobody did. And on Monday morning in Memphis in 1968, on February 12th, people looked to see, is anybody riding on the garbage trucks? Is anybody working? No, they weren't. That strike went on for about 2 months, and the men there were heroic. A lot of the story about King is the story of working class and poor people, including during the Montgomery bus boycott. 80% of those people were women who rode the buses. In the South at that time, almost everybody had so-called unskilled jobs, low-paid jobs. These were the people that made up the civil rights movement. So we get this image of King as the PhD, the very articulate leader, who could come in and bring some great insights into the movement, and that's what he did in Memphis. But we don't think about what's the background for King, and Dr. Carson has talked about that. He was a labor advocate from the very beginning, and so this was not new, but it's not something that people think about. They don't think about the March on Washington being the march for jobs and freedom. It was always part of the framework. He said civil rights and voting rights were phase one so that we would have rights to fight with. Now we want to open up the system for, as I was hearing Clay say, a moral revolution, a change in the socioeconomic system. That's a lot. Sorry.
Claiborne, do you want to join in with this also?
My own feeling is that if we wanted to map what's happening now on the history of what is usually called the civil rights movement, we're at an early stage of it. You know, I look upon what's happening as kind of the late 50s, early 60s, you know, where you have these movements popping up, Montgomery back then, and the sit-ins and, you know, different cities. And that's what I see happening with Black Lives Matter. I see that happening with protests about different kinds of issues, mass incarceration and things like that. But we're only beginning to develop a sense that this is one big movement. There's still very few people who are seeing the connections between the immigrant rights work that needs to be done and an issue like Black Lives Matter. But there are ways of connecting these. And once you begin to connect it, it becomes a stronger movement. And that's what happened in the 1960s. And that's what King was best at articulating. Because he was a visionary, he was able to see that there were these triple evils in the world, and they were interrelated. If you take on one, you have to take on the other to be effective. And furthermore, these are global issues. They're not likely to solve the problem of poverty in one country. Once you do, then everyone wants to move there who's poor someplace else. That's what's happening in so many ways. In the poor countries of the world, everyone wants a visa to come to Europe or the United States or Canada or someplace that is wealthier. Well, that doesn't really solve the basic problems, because once they get here, there's still poverty. So I think King was one of those who was kind of a theorist of globalism before we even used that term. He was aware that certainly we can't solve the problem of war, we can't solve the problem of poverty, and we can't really build a strong political movement as long as external fears divide people. That happened during the Cold War. The Cold War suppressed debate about political alternatives. That took some of the greatest freedom fighters out of the picture because they were silenced, like people like Paul Robeson and Du Bois. And I think that right now we have to have this dialogue across these boundaries, because a lot of energy is being developed. We see a million people in Washington over the single issue of gun violence in schools. But how are those people going to translate that into a movement for political power? How are those million people going to relate to the issue of guns, say, militarization of the police, mass incarceration? I can see the connections, but I wonder if they can. Without that, it's likely that you'll get these piecemeal reforms that might deal with the peripheries of issues without understanding that guns are simply a symbol of the overall militarization of American society. Glorification of war, the emphasis on military expenditures. Where do these guns come from in the first place? How do people develop a fascination with them, with military assault weapons? Now, these are the kinds of questions that I'm hoping that the million people who came to Washington will begin to think about. And hopefully over the next decade, we'll see if that gets translated into a political change. We have not had a single election in the last 50 years where white Americans and black Americans have voted for the same candidates. We've got to cross that bridge and begin to develop a movement that can pull the two political parties to the left rather than to the right.
And Mike Honey, in response to Dr. Carson, your thoughts on this and your thoughts to how King informs the discussions today. And I can't help but think about the sanitation strike, particularly in relationship to the Janus case, which is before the Supreme Court, and the really decimation and disrespect of the public sector workforce, which kind of takes me back to Memphis.
Yeah, we're at a very dangerous point. Dr. King came to Memphis at a time when public employees in many states did not have the right to even unionize or pay union dues. So Tennessee was one of those states. They call it right to work, but it's really right to work without a union. The Janus case, that plaintiff is saying that not only does he not have to belong to a union, which the courts, I think, have pretty much said you don't have to belong to a union, but in addition, if the union is representing you for wages, hours, and conditions, also I'm not going to pay any union dues. Even if they divide the dues up into some of it's for political donations, okay, you don't have to pay that part of it. But if somebody's representing you, somebody has to pay for that person. And that was the key point in the Memphis sanitation strike. Henry Loeb, the mayor of Memphis, he said you can have a union, but I won't recognize it, I won't sign a contract, and no way will you deduct union dues from your paycheck. And, of course, he knew that that kills the union, particularly with very poor people. They don't have money in their pockets to pay to a union organizer. If you have a union, you can raise the wages. King said a union is the best anti-poverty program for somebody who works. You can raise your wages, get better conditions, and the sanitation workers did all of those things once they won their strike. And then get dues deduction so that your union can function. No organization can function without any funds. That's the key thing that we're looking at now. And after the Memphis sanitation strike, Jesse Epps said Memphis was either the gate or the exit. You know, that if you couldn't win in Memphis, despite the union pouring everything it had basically into this fight, then you wouldn't be able to win anyplace else in the South. You know, it's horrible that Dr. King was killed here, but when I interviewed black workers for this book called Black Workers Remember, they said, yes, it was a terrible thing. But King knew that everywhere he went, that he was in the crosshairs of various people trying to kill him. He could have been killed in various places, but he knew that fighting for the rights of these sanitation workers was worth putting his life on the line. And so, remember, we won that strike, and AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, became the fastest-growing union in the country and has been for the last 50 years. And so this is what they're trying to stop with the right, so-called right-to-work laws. And Dr. King said he opposed those laws when they were trying to pass them in various states. They provide no rights, and they provide no work. So don't go along with this rhetoric. And the Koch brothers and the business forces on the right, the Chamber of Commerce, they love this. It's a non-union environment. That's what they're after. So in Memphis, we're talking about 50 years since King, what's happened economically. One of the things that's very clear from all the statistics about Memphis is that the workforce has changed. The big factories have closed. Those were the big unionized workforces. Once upon a time, about 20% of workers in Memphis belonged to unions. That's all been pretty much destroyed by deindustrialization and so-called globalization. But the jobs have expanded dramatically in healthcare and social services and all kinds of services, including people who are better educated, college educated, and so forth. But they don't have unions. And so people wonder why, when the economy is expanding and profits are shooting through the roof for quite a few years now, that wages are stagnant. Well, who's going to push those wages up if you don't have a union? And if you don't do something about that, you're not going to be able to alleviate poverty. And Memphis is a great case study of that. But so is the whole country. You know, we had 40 million poor people when Dr. King was here, and now we still have 40 million poor people. And a lot of them are workers that have been knocked out of the economy by mechanization or globalization, and the working poor who have jobs, but they're not making a living income. So the Memphis story for AFSCME and these other unions and the fight for 15 people provides a narrative about, you know, this is what we need to do, this is what Dr. King said we need to do. It's one aspect. Like Clay said, it's a whole huge set of issues that are all interrelated, but one aspect of it is fighting for the rights of workers and increasing wages. And it's not going to happen from the government. It's going to have to happen from the people fighting for these things.
Michael, I think it's also important for people to realize that the new economy of the 21st century creates a sense of isolation of workers, so that you feel that you are working as one person rather than a group. As you mentioned, factories have closed down. We don't have a lot of that anymore. We have a gig economy where everyone negotiates individually with their employer. There's no sense of commonality with other workers. In fact, there's a sense of almost competition with other workers. You know, for example, when I drove a taxi, I was a member of a union back in my college days. Now, if you work for Uber or Lyft or any of those places, you're considered an individual contractor. You provide your own car, your own insurance, and you're out there competing with every other driver. It's an economy designed to make every other worker your competition rather than a potential ally. It's going to be a long, hard struggle because that has become entrenched. The privatization of many jobs have made it more and more difficult for people to organize in any effective way. So one of the things
that Dr. King brought out that I think we could return to is this idea about changing the values of America, the priorities of America. Part of that is the simple idea of solidarity and overcoming this isolation, as you're talking about. The system is designed to keep us from having solidarity. So organizations are trying to find ways around that. So the Fight for 15, for example, is trying to organize fast food workers, realizing they'll probably not get a union. But if we put enough pressure, picket lines, public things, so we don't have the power of a union, but we have the power of organization and public pressure, then it's possible to get back to that idea of solidarity. And I think that goes across the board. Dr. King said it very simply on March 18th in Memphis in 1968, we can all get more together than we can get separately. And this is a moral position, of course, but it's also a very functional economic framework, and also for building these broad coalitions that Dr. Carson's talking about.
I'm particularly interested in what strikes you about and what came together for the last campaign of King, which actually was more of his campaign rather than joining in other grassroots activism that was going on throughout the South. And that's the Poor People's Campaign, which place the demand for housing and health care and education and jobs or adequate income for all. Your thoughts, both of you, on the significance of that effort, and we should mention that we've certainly had on the Reverend William Barber, who seems to have inherited that mantle and is carrying forth the Poor People's Campaign, which we hope certainly builds to a national movement. But Mike Honey, Claiborne Carson.
One of the things that King, there's a great quote in this new book. He said, I'm not just concerned about the African-American poor. I'm concerned about the white poor. I'm concerned about the Latino poor. I'm concerned about the Puerto Rican poor. I'm concerned about the Native American poor. I'm concerned about poor people in general, and it's global. So, you know, we're certainly at a time when I think that kind of talk and framework is so appropriate.
Civil rights gains in the 1960s has made us very complacent about our losses in other areas. The sign of unionization is very important. The rise of the union move brought us the expectation of things like pensions and health care plans that were for large numbers of workers. In the decline of unions, we see so many people outside of any of these protections. Every worker is responsible for taking care of their own health care, taking care of their own pension. And that's very difficult to do when you're at the bottom of the economic structure anyway. It'd be good if we at least were moving toward a society where we have national health care, in which we have a strong social security system. But we see even these kind of gains that we had earlier being destroyed in the 21st century. I mean, who would have thought that we would be going downhill? We have more and more people who are just marginal in terms of the economy. Trying to organize them is going to be tough. You know, if sanitation workers who had no protections could finally reach the point of desperation when they knew that they had to join together, I think that's where we are as a nation and maybe as a world. A lot of people are at that point of desperation. That can drive you in two different directions. You know, you can direct your resentment upward, and that's difficult, or you can direct your resentment towards people who are even more oppressed than you are because you see them as competition. I fear the latter. From the last election return, that's what's obviously happening with many white workers, is that rather than understanding that they are getting clobbered from above, they turn their resentment on those who are even less fortunate. We live in a very difficult time, and I'm hopeful because I think young people are beginning to understand that.
Clayton Carson, if you can just tell us, we're going to hear a piece from Dr. King now, and I wonder if you can just quickly set it up for us.
The recording is from King's Nobel Prize lecture. This was in December of 1964, at a time when Martin Luther King was beginning to lay out his broader agenda. The Civil Rights Act of 64 had been passed, and he used this as an occasion to focus on the three issues that he had already laid out in his letter to Coretta back in 1952, where he also laid out three similar concerns, and basically saying that I'm moving beyond simply the race issue and getting to focus on the global issues of poverty and war. So I think in this speech, you can clearly understand the direction he was moving at the end of 1964.
Let's listen.
The problem of spiritual and moral lag, which constitutes modern man's chief dilemma, expresses itself in three larger problems. Each of these problems, while appearing to be separate, is inextricably bound to the other. I refer to racial injustice, poverty, and war. The struggle to eliminate the evil of racial injustice constitutes one of the major struggles of our time. The present upsurge of the Negro people of the United States grows out of a deep and passionate determination to make freedom and equality a reality here and now. What is happening in the United States today is a relatively small part of a world development. What we are seeing now is a freedom explosion. The deep rumbling of discontent that we hear today is the thunder of disinherited masses rising from dungeons of oppression to the bright hills of freedom in one majestic chorus. The rising masses are singing in the words of our freedom song, ain't gonna let nobody turn us around. The era of colonialism is at an end. East is meeting West. The earth is being redistributed. Yet something within has reminded the Negro of his birthright of freedom. And something without has reminded him that it can be gained. And with his black brothers of Africa and his brown and yellow brothers in Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, the United States Negro is moving with a sense of great urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. A second evil which plagues the modern world is that of poverty. It projects its nagging, prehensile tentacles in lands and villages all over the world. Almost two-thirds of the peoples of the world go to bed hungry at night. They are undernourished, ill-housed, and shabbily clad. Many of them have no houses or beds to sleep in. Their only beds are the sidewalks of the cities and the dusty roads of the villages. Most of these poverty-stricken children of God have never seen a physician or a dentist. This problem of poverty is not only seen in the class division between the highly developed industrial nations and the so-called underdeveloped nations. It is seen in the great economic gaps within the rich nations themselves. Take my own country, for example. We have developed the greatest system of production that history has ever known. We have become the richest nation in the world, yet at least one-fifth of our fellow citizens, comprising about 40 million individuals, are bound to a miserable culture of poverty. The poor in America know that they live in the richest nation in the world, and that even though they are perishing on a lonely island of poverty, they are surrounded by the vast ocean of material prosperity. If man is to redeem his spiritual and moral lag, he must go all out to bridge the social and economic gulf between the haves and the have-nots of the world. Poverty is one of the most urgent items on the agenda of modern life. Why should there be hunger and privation in any land, in any city, at any table, when man has the resources and the scientific know-how to provide all mankind with the basic necessities of life? Just as nonviolence exposed the ugliness of racial injustice, so must the infection and sickness of poverty be exposed and healed, not only its symptoms, but its basic causes. This, too, will be a fierce struggle, but we must not be afraid to pursue the remedy, no matter how formidable the task. The time has come for an all-out war against poverty.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King speaking shortly after he received the Nobel Peace Prize. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.